From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the April 2025 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. VE Day 80, Objects and Memories.
VE Day, Victory in Europe Day, was the 8th of May 1945. It was the day that the German surrender was formally enacted. The end of the war was rather a mixed event at Bletchley Park. We know that lots of people had lots of different experiences. People's memories that have been passed down and the objects that have survived tell a real variety of stories, and it's some of those that we'll be bringing you today. We'll be speaking to our research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, to our research officer, Dr. Thomas Cheatham, and to the museum archivist, Dean Anderson, about a variety of treasures from our collection, including a famous photograph, a Morse message, an emotional letter, and we'll be hearing the voice of one of our wonderful veterans. We'll start with David Kenyon. Before we look at this treasure that you have, David, can you give us a bit of background about VE Day? What did the end of the war and particularly VE Day look like at Bletchley Park?
What's quite striking about VE Day at Bletchley Park is that the popular image of the day is of people in Trafalgar Square partying and, you know, the whole country going crazy because the war's finished. I think at Bletchley Park, it would have been a lot more low key. And what you have to appreciate is the organisation was going full steam ahead, doing all of the different code breaking and intelligence analysis tasks that they were doing. And although everyone here would have known that the end of the war was coming soon, that particular Tuesday, they would have all turned up to work as usual. And to be suddenly told the Germans have surrendered, you know it's going to happen one day, but you never think it's going to be today. And then suddenly it is.
It would have been a real small handful of people that would have known, do you think?
Well, I think word spread around the site pretty fast because a lot of veterans recall how someone came into their room or wherever they were working and said, the Germans have surrendered. In a number of cases, there was 5 minutes of cheering and then the boss said, never mind that, carry on, you know. And of course, you have to remember that only half the war is over. The war against Japan is reaching its peak in many ways, and the build-up towards the inevitable, it felt inevitable at the time, the land invasion of Japan, is at full steam. So a big portion of the people working here have nothing to do with the European war anyway. So their work carries on absolutely as normal. On the other hand, the people who've been working on German material and the European war, the impression you get from the veteran testimony is two things. One is exhaustion. There's a number of memoirs where people say, I was told I could stop working, so I literally just lay on the floor and went to sleep because I was knackered. And if you think about the shift patterns people have been working and how hard they've been working for how long, just that constant tiredness and just fatigue of this grinding day by day routine, suddenly be told you can stop now. It's like when you finish your exams at school or something, you just conk out. That's some people's experience. Other people, there's a sense of jeopardy because their whole lives have been dominated by doing this task. And if you think about a lot of the, particularly the female employees who've come straight from school into this work, and they might have been doing it for 3-4 years, suddenly to be told, oh, you don't need to do this anymore. What do you do now? And there was quite a lot of uncertainty about, now the war's finished, I'm going to need to get another job, I'm going to need to do whatever I'm going to do. So yes, you've got happiness, but also you've got uncertainty, and overriding the whole lot, you've just got tiredness.
And whilst VE Day was a specific day that we know people stopped work for a period of time, there wasn't the lights go off in offices and then there's a huge bonfire of all the materials they were working on.
Absolutely not. I mean, one of the mythologies of Bletchley is that Winston Churchill ordered everything to be burnt so the secret could be kept. That wasn't really the case at all. The notorious thing about World War II that historians say all the time, that the Cold War against the Soviet Union started almost immediately. And GCNCS, GCHQ, was aware that their code breaking would have to continue, that just the target had changed. So there's a big effort to wind the organisation down, but at the same time not lose any knowledge of what was being done. And so people who've been doing code breaking are now tasked with writing up the methodologies, sorting all the paperwork and keeping the important stuff so that if they need to rev the whole organisation up again in 5 years' time, they're able to do it. To simply destroy everything and shut everything down would have been a massive mistake. So although some people are almost literally made redundant on the day, most people might get a bit of leave, but then a week later they come back and they start on these winding down tasks that for many people on the European side continue in some cases for months. Or for some people, years, because the historical team, the people, sort of the knowledge capture people, carry on right up to the early 50s, writing stuff down and making sure that they've recorded all the information they need to know.
And some people stayed at GCHQ, as it was known at the end of the war, obviously for years afterwards as well.
Yes, I mean, famous code breakers like Margaret Rock, she carried on. Mavis Beatty carried on.
Joan Clark.
A minority of people do stay in the job, but the organisation goes from nearly 9,000 down to about between 1,000 and 2,000. Most people are basically laid off at some point in the course of the rest of the summer.
While much of the Allied world is already celebrating VE Day, the official announcement that the war in Europe has ended will not be made until tomorrow. Earlier, CBS correspondent Edward Murrow in London said that President Truman and Prime Minister Churchill were ready to announce the official news of the German surrender at 9 a.m. today, but he said that they were delayed because Premier Stalin, scheduled to speak at the same time, was not ready. The first Associated Press flash from Reims in France saying that Germany had surrendered was followed 2 hours later by a broadcast by ABSI, the American broadcasting station in Europe. Supreme Headquarters, in the meantime, had issued a statement not denying the truth of the AP flash, but saying that no official announcement had been authorized.
There are these formal records which describe what different departments did, which were created at the end of the war, which are at the National Archives. But the informal stories about people's VE days and at the end of the war are what we're going to be focusing on today, and some of the artifacts, if I can use that word, of that time that have survived. David, you have some items that have recently come into our collection that you wanted us to focus on. Can you tell us a bit about what you've got there?
I can. To give you a little bit of background, a few months ago, a lady visited Bletchley Park. I was chatting to her and she described the fact that she had come across some material that she thought was from Bletchley, and she brought it with her because she was keen for us to see it. And I immediately got on the phone to our archivist, Dean, and he came over and we had a look. And subsequently, we've been able to acquire digital copies of the material. This is one of the things we do in our archives, that quite often families or people who have ephemera associated with Bletchley Park, they want to keep it and they don't necessarily want to donate it to us. But what we do is we scan it in a very high resolution and we keep it in our archives in digital form. And it means we can give the objects back to the family, be it letters or photographs or whatever. And that's exactly what we did here. What this lady bought was a series of documents that she'd actually bought in a house clearance sale. She collects memorabilia associated with women in World War II. She saw this material about a woman in World War II and thought, well, I'll have that.
No relation to her?
No relation to her. As far as she was aware, the person who was selling it wasn't a relation to her. So the woman in question, we know relatively little about. However, she is on our roll of honour. The lady in question is a woman called leading aircraft woman Edith Kettle, who was a member of the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. And the material that was brought in was things we quite often see. There was her service and release book from the RAF, which gave some information about her rank and serial number and all those sorts of information. What's quite nice about that document is it also includes a handwritten testimonial, which she can use as almost like a job reference in the future.
Those are quite vague though, aren't they, those job references, surely?
This one is not completely vague.
Ooh.
This one actually gives away some information about what she did, which is potentially unusual. Some of them just say, an employee of the Foreign Office who was fantastic, please give her a job. This one is more specific. I can read it to you. It says that Edith was, quote, a capable and experienced wireless operator who had 3 years at a large signal centre on hand and automatic circuits. She is given every satisfaction and is suitable for similar civilian employment or alternatively clerical work. So she's a trained wireless operator, which is quite a skill. That confirms what we know from our roll of honour record for her, which was that she was a wireless operator, but more importantly, also a slip reader. And she was working on slip reading in D watch of the auto room in the communication centre in Block E. That's a lot of complicated phrases I've given you there. Actually, Tom is the expert on the auto room and on slip reading. So we'll pass over to Tom to tell us a little bit about that, and then we'll come back to Edith.
The auto room operates high-speed wireless links, Morse links, with overseas intercept stations, Y stations. So it's set up at Bletchley Park as part of quite a large RAF project, and it's one of the RAF's biggest contributions to the whole signals intelligence operation, to get intercepts to Bletchley Park from overseas. And eventually this whole network that they set up, and it comes operational in about 1943, it carries as much traffic as the whole pre-existing RAF wireless network. This is one of the reasons why Edith Kettle receives that quite honest reference about what her wartime work had been. This is treated by the RAF as a standard signals centre like any other. Most of the people involved don't really have an idea that they're working in intelligence, that they're part of this intelligence system. So you have about 400 staff, mostly Women's Auxiliary Air Force, working in the auto room, and their main job is to take messages as they arrive. They're produced on slips of paper, known as Morse slip, as a pattern of peaks and troughs in a wavy line, which represent your Morse code. And their task is to interpret that back into readable text, and then it can move on down the production line, so to speak, through decryption, because it's all been enciphered before being sent to Bletchley Park, and then after that onto the codebreakers. You have about a dozen mobile high-speed wireless units run by the RAF called heavy mobile units working to Bletchley Park, and also army units as well. And another interesting item we have in the Edith Kettle collection, which is quite common actually, at the end of the war, a message was disseminated to all the staff from the Director General, Stuart Mingus, thanking them for their work. Essentially, everybody gets a copy of this, and many of the versions which have come down to us have top secret ultra stamps on or various annotation signatures from people they were working with. But Edith Kettle's copy is covered in stamps which would have been available in the auto room, naming all of their heavy mobile units or HMUs and all of the other people they were working with around the world. The stamps for Ottawa, the stamps for Colombo, and all of the places that the auto room is in touch with around the world. So they're keeping Bletchley Park in touch with global interception, and a very large proportion of all the traffic that's been broken here is arriving in the auto room. And that's in many ways the start of the process, even though the staff working there wouldn't know much about it. You can learn all about communications at Bletchley Park if you listen to episode 150 of this podcast, which is called Communication is Key.
This image I'm looking at is a piece of paper. It is pinkish, and it has lines and lines of those strips of those wavy lines that Tom was talking about. So clearly that undulator tape that's been pasted on to this template, which has printed boxes in it with words like serial number, address, message indicator, and so on, that would be filled clearly by the person that was working on this bit of paper. It's not at all clear what this message means, because it's just purple squiggly lines on tape. And it isn't clear whether this is encrypted, so even if it could be read, would it make any sense? David, shed some more light on what we're looking at here.
What we're looking at here is, as far as I can tell, a typical Morse slip message sheet. And essentially, the purpose behind this system is if someone sends Morse by hand, you're limited to how fast they can tap out the dots and dashes. High-speed Morse, you type the message into a machine that prints all the dots and dashes into a tape, and then you can spin that tape through your wireless very, very quickly. And what it does is it sends Morse code much, much faster than a person could tap it out, or even a person could hear it and write it down. So it means you can send far more messages in the same amount of time on your network as you would if you did it by hand.
So on a wireless, it wouldn't come across as that.
It would, but it would come up much, much faster. What comes out of the machine, as you said, is this thin paper tape, and the pen runs along the bottom of the tape. And if you get a dot, it creates a little spike. If you get a dash, it goes up and then travels along a bit, drops down again. So you get a little sort of rectangular hump. And what we have on the sheet are just a whole series of spikes and humps. What I did was to take these spikes and humps and turn them back into Morse code, and then from Morse code, turn them into alphabet to see what they said. Two things are rather brilliant about this message. One is it's not encrypted. It's not a whole load of gibberish. It would have been a wonderful object, even if it were gibberish, because very, very few examples of Morse slip survived. I don't think we had any before we saw this one. And it was such a common process, especially towards the end of the war. But these slips were routinely destroyed. Once you've translated the message off the sheet, you don't need to keep the slip, so it'll be chucked away. So to have an example of Morse slip in the first place is a really nice thing. What makes this one even more special is we can deduce from it that it was sent on VE Day or on the 7th of May, probably just prior to VE Day.
And I should add, there are a few plain text scribbles that have been added to it in handwriting. I can just about make out somebody's added 7545 at the top, 7th of May, 1945.
Yes. And what they've started to do in pencil, someone has started to unpick the Morse code and write alphabetical letters underneath, so we could see part of what it said.
But you read the whole thing.
But I worked systematically through the whole thing. And what it said is actually quite surprising. You have to imagine Edith is sitting at her Morse slip machine, and this message comes to her. It's sort of three chunks. I can read you the first section. It says, "Molto grazie per vostro greetings. Stay drunk for days. We are. Saluti from all ear," with no H. And then three crosses for kisses. So not your typical traffic.
No. is this traffic that would have come through to Bletchley Park?
Yes. Given that Edith kept this piece of paper along with her other bits and pieces from Bletchley Park, we don't have any testimony from her, so we don't know exactly. The obvious inference is she kept her pay book, she kept the letter from Mingy's, and she also kept this.
I love it. Someone sat in Block E and they've got this appearing in front of them and they're typing out and this appears.
Yes, she spent several years typing out what was probably just alphabetical gibberish, and suddenly she gets this plain language message.
Wonderful.
However, it goes on. And you can see there's a certain amount of operator text here. It says flash, XQ, XQ, bus, V, BTQ, XQ, special. And these are all little acronyms and terminology that indicate an important message. The important message is special V-Day tomorrow. War finito. KO. Loss. Ended. Roll on Burma. And then we get XQ, XQ, XQ again. And then the really surprising bit, how about a date on June 23rd in Glasgow, possibly?
That's bold.
I mean, what we're reading is a message from the operator in the HMU, the heavy mobile unit, in this case in Italy, to judge by the fact he's using Italian terminology. It'll be a British operator, but he's in Italy. I can't imagine he necessarily knows Edith. He might have communicated with her before, but why he's asking her out and why he thinks he can confirm that he'll be in Glasgow on June the 23rd.
And find her. How wonderful.
But yes, it's a bold gamble. The final section kind of reiterates the mood of the whole thing, which is XQ, 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 bus, V, VTL, XQ. Good night all. Off now to get drunk good and proper. We'll drink to all of you. Questa sera. So you can see why she kept it.
Totally. This is fantastic.
It's somebody out in Italy who's learnt that the war has ended and they know there's a lady at the other end of the line.
It sort of represents a sense of that jubilation that war is at an end. I suppose it's the over the airwaves version of kissing somebody in Trafalgar Square, isn't it?
Pretty much, yes. Tom and I haven't been able to work out exactly where 23 HMU was, but clearly there was a celebratory atmosphere in the office at their end as well. So a wonderful object for our collection, because not only is it technically very interesting as a sample of Morse slip, but also there's a human story in there, which is rather marvellous, I think.
And we don't often find stuff like this in the National Archives, do we? This is one of those lovely...
Not really.
Brilliant.
This is the BBC Home Service. We're interrupting programmes to make the following announcement. It is understood that in accordance with arrangements between the three great powers, an official announcement will be broadcast by the Prime Minister at 3 o'clock tomorrow, Tuesday afternoon, the 8th of May. In view of this fact, tomorrow, Tuesday, will be treated as Victory in Europe Day and will be regarded as a holiday. The day following, Wednesday, the 9th of May, will also be a holiday.
We're with Research Officer Thomas Cheetham, who is looking at a photograph of a group of men and women, quite a few of them. This is a photograph that many of our listeners may have seen before, and in the past has been described as the VE Day photograph. Tom, can you tell us more about what we're looking at here?
Yes. Now, if you've ever read a book about Bletchley Park, or if you've seen an article about the end of the war here, you've probably seen one of four photos which purport to show staff on VE Day. But it's a photo of a large group of men and women facing the camera. They're all lined up. They're smiling. Clearly, it's a social occasion. Some are sitting on the ground. Some have glasses and others are smoking and they're generally looking relaxed. They're in smart workwear. The women haven't got their evening frocks on, but they're clearly dressed up for the occasion to some extent. And we have a whole range of figures and go into detail of some of those in a moment. It's normally captioned something like staff of huts 3 and 6 on VE Day at Bletchley Park. So these are some of the most famous photographs of people at Bletchley Park, but they're also some of the most misunderstood. But at this point in time, we here at Bletchley Park Trust have pieced together almost the whole story of what they actually show.
What were we able, and I say we because I also helped out with this bit of research, I'm pleased to say, what were we able to deduce from the photographs themselves?
First off, we can look at what they actually show us and what's evident from the photos themselves. So there's four photos in total. They're taken of two different groups, and evidently in each case, seconds apart. And the first pair are almost identical. People have changed facial expression or shifted slightly. The second pair, slightly further apart, and you can see between photo one and photo two being taken, people have crowded into shot.
Come over here, there's more, get more in.
Absolutely. We can tell they're taken in pretty much the same place because of the foliage in the background. The staff are standing on what looks like a concrete hut base or a path, maybe. There's not a lot that helps us identify the scene, but we can see a fence behind them. So my assumption from this is we're probably looking at a point towards the north end of the Bletchley Park site, and behind them is sort of the open parkland which remained of the Leon estate, which hadn't been built over.
So on the perimeter of the site.
Absolutely, and they've picked a spot where they're not going to give away anything from the point of view of secrecy about where they might be. We've got lots of copies of these photos. They're clearly widely circulated at the time. We've got at least 10 different copies in our collection donated by all sorts of people.
Of the full photographs?
Yeah, not normally all the photos together, but normally one or two of them. And often these are captioned and people have attempted and gone back later and tried to name some of the people they recognise. And not every version names every person, but by cross-referencing the different versions we've got, we have been able to compile a pretty much full list of names of the people shown. And we know from other information that almost everybody in the photos worked in Hut 6. There are only a handful of staff who might arguably be said to be from Hut 3 here. And there's a strong showing from the American contingent who are working here as cryptanalysts from 6813 Signal Security Detachment of the US Signal Corps.
There are people in uniform, men in uniform in particular, in this photograph, aren't they?
Yeah, British and American. There's also a little bit of representation from the 6th, the traffic analysis section, which I will talk about more in a moment. What we were able to say quite early on is that this photo could not actually have been taken on VE Day.
Aha.
There are people here who we know were away from Bletchley Park on that day. Asa Briggs, Lord Briggs, who is a very, very well-known social historian later in life, is in the photo, but he was on leave on VE Day. And he tells us in his memoirs, there is a US-British couple, John Hyman and his future wife, Patricia Nee Burkett, in the photo. They actually married in Sheffield on VE Day itself.
Bet that was quite the party.
I'm sure it was, but they couldn't have been at Bletchley Park. And again, some of the other personnel, some of the senior figures, were actually away in Europe as part of the TICOM missions. They were hunting down Nazi cryptographers in Germany on VE Day, so it can't possibly be taken on that date. And likewise, there's various indications it can't be VJ Day either.
Because of people who are or aren't in the actual photograph.
Absolutely.
So we know when it wasn't. We know it wasn't VE Day and we know it wasn't VJ Day, but they're clearly celebrating something. What happened next in your research?
That's where things sat for a few years until we received another donation of a photo. And this one was from the family of a Jane Morris. Now, Jane Morris worked in Hut 6. She's in one of the photos. She captions herself as me on the back of her copy. And that makes her quite a reliable witness because she clearly knew most of these people personally. And what's really interesting is about her captioning is she names almost everybody apart from the people from Sixter who she wouldn't have known professionally. So we can kind of infer from that she wasn't making assumptions. She wasn't trying to fill in gaps where she didn't really have the information. She probably added those names to the back of the photo relatively soon after the war because she does a very complete job and we can verify that using the other copies.
Mm-hmm. I love this as well because it's that example of huts or teams not necessarily socializing with each other and not knowing each other and that they kept very much to themselves.
Absolutely. And she gives us an absolutely crucial piece of evidence because Morris, in her photo album, labelled her copy American Farewell Party.
Thank you, Jane Morris.
And that's really plausible. That just fits. Because we know sometime in the summer of 1945, the Americans would have packed up and left. And of course, there would have been these social occasions going on. And it explains why there's so many well-known American figures in the photos and that they seem to be the centre of attention.
Yeah. So when was the American Farewell Party?
So we still didn't know the date. Because Jane didn't tell us that. But again, we had to wait a little bit of time. But we got another copy, yet another one, from the family of Frank Stanton, one of the Americans. And he gives a date in his photo album. His record keeping is rather good. And he dates it to Friday, the 29th of June, 1945.
Fantastic.
Bingo. So we've got the full picture there. What's nice is also in Frank Stanton's album, there are some photos which appear to show some sort of party and quite heavy drinking taking place up at the American Billiton Little Brick Hill on the 26th of June. So they have their own party at their billet, and then a few days later, Friday night, last day of work presumably at Bletchley Park.
Yeah, make the most of it.
They go out for drinks in the sun that evening. Everyone lines up by the fence and has these photos taken.
And it looks like nice weather in the photograph as well. It's the end of June. That all matches.
We also know from Stanton, again, because he photographed it, that his unit departed the UK on the SS Queen Mary around the 26th of September, which we didn't know before. So we know when the Americans left. And it's evident from what they're doing in the meantime that they're not doing a lot of work. And during the 8 weeks or so between finishing up at Bletchley Park and actually going back to the States, many of the American personnel take the opportunity to make trips to Scotland or to Cornwall or to various sightseeing trips in the UK to make the most of their time here. And a final tentative point I might make is that, interestingly, Frank Stanton isn't actually in the photos taken at the US farewell party. So was he there? Was he busy? Could he have been the photographer?
Could he have been the photographer? Well, that's it. If he has a photograph album and he has the photographs a few days earlier of the Americans at their own billet.
But only one copy, so...
Oh, it's so tantalising, isn't it? Just to find out who it might have been. My brain sort of thinks, well, the farewell party took place, but they didn't leave for another couple of months. Could that have been the time to distribute multiple copies of this photograph to all the various people included? And so that's why so many people have copies. My goodness. Maybe that's the next step. Maybe it'll take us a couple more years and then someone else will come forward with a bit more information. My question for you is, why have so many people got the facts wrong? Or why did we have to unpick this in the first place?
Well, it's just a really good reminder why our veterans are a vital source of information, of course, but we can't always take everybody at their word. And what seems to have happened in most cases is the photo went in a drawer and people pretty much forgot about it and maybe intentionally filed it away and intended not for it not to be found. And then many years later, it was recovered. And most people remember that there was some sort of social shindig towards the end of the war associated with victory. And naturally, a lot of people assumed the occasion was VE Day. And then as veterans talk to each other and when they start talking to historians, this misconception starts to take hold and suddenly it becomes self-reinforcing. And eventually everybody just knows this is VE Day at Bletchley Park. So it's a really good example of why, even with really well-accepted information, you have to go back to the original evidence and say, right, why do we know this? What's the original source of our supposition? And weigh up all the evidence to get to the truth.
And I guess it's easy to make an assumption. They're celebrating, must have been VE Day, because that's the thing that a lot of people have knowledge about culturally and social history-wise. That's, of course, the reason that they would be stood outside with glasses or with cups in their hands. What can we learn, in addition to the fact that it was on that date and for that purpose? What can we learn from these photographs?
I think what's really interesting is what it tells you about the sort of social fabric at Bletchley. So you have real high flyers rubbing shoulders with everybody else. We know we have lots of descriptions of how meritocratic Hut 6 was as a place to work, but this is really good kind of physical evidence of it. You have people like Bill Bundy, who's head of the American contingent, and he later works in the White House during the Vietnam era, and he's an advisor to JFK and LBJ and Richard Nixon on Vietnam. And incredibly successful in that role. And he's a senior figure at Bletchley Park, but he's there amongst all the other faces. You have Arthur Levinson, who's a leading light at the NSA during the Cold War until the 1970s. You have Howard Smith, who is British ambassador to Czechoslovakia and then Moscow. And he's director general of MI5 in late 1970s, early 80s, all rubbing shoulders with everybody else. So you can really get a sense of how these people really fitted in. Another aspect of that is you see several married couples that we know of. So I mentioned John and Patricia Hyman, but there's others in the photos who are standing next to or in front of or behind their wives and girlfriends and future spouses. So again, we have lots of evidence from the memoirs of how common relationships were that sprung up during the war. It's nice to see those evidence in the photos as well.
If Hut 6 and Sixter didn't know each other generally, why are they in the same photograph?
Yes, and this is a really nice example of those social relationships. So amongst all the other figures, we have two male military officers in their uniforms from Sixter, and they were responsible for liaison with other sections. You have Neil Webster. I've talked about his work in the past in the podcast we did on traffic analysis. He mostly worked with Hut 6. You also have Edward Rushworth, who worked more closely with Hut 3. But they're the two men who keep Sixter really in contact with the rest of Bletchley Park. And so it's not too surprising that they might be included and invited to this party. We also have, though, three women from Sixter. We know they worked in the fusion room in that section. They're Joyce Robinson, Jean Davies, later Woolwork, and Joan Watkins, later Fursk. And during wartime, they worked together. They spent time together outside of work. They're best mates. They'd known each other at this point for 3 or 4 years. They're known at Bletchley Park as the Free Jays. And the reason they are at this party was that Joyce Robinson was engaged to Edward Rushworth.
Uh-huh.
And so it doesn't take much supposition to work out that Rushworth found out this party was going on, and he went over to Block G, where Sixter was still working, and found Joyce and her friends and invited them along too. And that's why they're the only kind of outsiders in this group who are in the photo.
Right.
And if we needed confirmation, we have a bit because we have some correspondence sent between the Thirsks and their friends and some of the other veterans in the 1990s. And amongst other discussions, they talk about circumstances of the photo. And even though they're wrong about it being VE Day, Joan Thirsk writes to Asa Briggs in one of those letters saying, "Mostly the people in the photos are from Hut 6, but we think the invitation came to us via Rush and it was really a Hut 6 party." So you can almost discern the minute-by-minute events of the day that would have led to those people being outside with this group and having the photo taken.
I can imagine the conversations they must have been having as well. Like, "I've heard this party's on. Why don't you come? Ask your friends. Let's head over." That's absolutely fantastic. So aside from being a fantastic image, photographs like this can help us build more research knowledge as well.
Yeah, so for our online Roll of Honour, we've been able to go through these photos. In some cases, we've been able to add new names because we can see pretty clearly that if people haven't been picked up from any other sources, if they're in this photo, they must have worked at Bletchley Park, probably in Hut 6. And in other cases, we're able to add to our Roll of Honour some photographs of individuals who we didn't have any other photos of. It's one part of the jigsaw that helps us tell the whole Bletchley Park story a little bit more fully.
"And now, oh, what wonderful luck. At this moment, how wonderful, Mr. Churchill has come out onto the Ministry of Health balcony. Now, Mr. Churchill stands on the balcony of the Ministry of Health. He's wearing his boiler suit, the famous boiler suit that he's made so wonderful. And he had the audacity, shall I say, to put on his head his famous black hat. Nobody can say that it goes with a boiler suit, but you heard what a cheer it raised from the crowd. He stands now in the floodlights, and he's giving the victory sign for all his might from the flooded balcony."
As David told us earlier, after the German surrender, the various teams at Bletchley Park reduced the amount of work that they did, or some were disbanded. With teams that have been working on German messages, obviously some had little or no work to do, and then others had their work changed. We can see this in one of the teams at Bletchley Park, the Newmanry, and the head of the Newmanry, John Herivel, wrote a document which we have in front of us right now and which we'll be talking about. I'm with Dean Anderson, museum archivist. Dean, before we look at the document, can you tell us who was John Herivel?
John Herivel was born in Belfast in 1918. He was educated at Methodist College. And in 1937, he won a scholarship to study mathematics at Sidney Sussex College, Cambridge. And his supervisor there was a certain Gordon Welshman.
Who we may have heard of before.
We have. We have a transcript of a speech that Herivel gave at the opening of an exhibition relating to him here at Bletchley Park in 2001. And he talks about how he and a friend of his used to go to Welshman's room once a week with mathematical problems he had set them to solve. And he would discuss and criticise their solutions. Welshman left Cambridge at the start of the war and soon became head of Hut 6, the hut responsible for decrypting German Army and Air Force Enigma messages. And he obviously thought a lot of Herivel and soon helped to recruit him to the Hut 6 team in January 1940.
John Herivel isn't a name that we bring up very frequently on the Bletchley Park podcast, but he is quite renowned, if you know, you know. Can you tell us what is John Herivel most famous for?
So at the start of each day, before any messages were sent or received, German Enigma operators implemented the day's rotor selection and ring settings. They were then supposed to move the rotors randomly, selecting a new position for the rotors and sending them as a three-letter indicator at the start of his first message. And quite soon after starting at Bletchley Park, Herivel thought about what these German operators might do if they were working under stress, or if they were frightened, or if they were in a hurry or tired. And he thought they may just leave the rotors where they were, or at least only move them a few notches. This reduced the possibilities for each letter significantly. And from May 1940, the Herivel tip, as it became known, was used as the main method for finding the ring settings in order to break Luftwaffe traffic. And it continued to be the main method until the first bomb machine was delivered in August 1940.
You mentioned that we have a transcript of a speech that Herivel gave in 2001 at Bletchley Park. We actually have some audio from that event as well, and we can listen to John Herivel talking about the Herivel tip in his own words.
The war broke out in September 1939, and Wurzman immediately came to Bletchley. He disappeared. There were rumours in the college that he was doing some very important secret work in Bletchley, but nobody, of course, knew what it was, and they never did. And then the following January, towards the end of the month, I was just about to begin to do some revision when there was a knock at the door, and in darted Gordon Wurzman, of course I never called him Gordon, and asked me whether I'd like to come to Bletchley, say for it was, and do some very important work. As I was just about to have to do revision, I was only too glad to agree to escape from this toil. And on the 29th of January, 1940, I found myself at Bletchley. And of course, only a few weeks later, I had this happy inspiration, which eventually was christened the Herivel Tip by Wurzman. Actually, Tony Kendrick had a much nicer name for it. We called it Herivelismus, which I prefer. However, Herivel Tip it must be. So a few weeks later, I had this idea, and I went into Hut 6 the next day and told my colleagues, of whom there were very few. There was David Rees, there was Malcolm Chamberlain, there was myself, and there was Wurzman, and there was Dennis Babbage. I told him about this, and Wurzman immediately saw the possibility of this working. Because, you see, it's very difficult to know what to call the Herivel Tip. It's not a theory. It's not exactly a speculation. What it really said was that under certain circumstances, it's possible that some people may be rather slack. And in that case, if you look at all the first three letters of all the first messages of the day, you'll get some idea about the ringstone. So that was all a matter of possibilities and probabilities and so on. But one thing I was very clear about from the beginning was that it would be much more likely to happen if the operators, German operators, were working under great stress in their office. People make mistakes when they're frightened or in a hurry or very tired. So Wurzman immediately cottoned on to this. He must have, because he ordered the receiving station to send these first messages of the day each day to Bletchley Park as soon as possible.
I like the fact that despite Herivel being a mathematician, it wasn't a mathematical solution that he came up with, but he was kind of thinking outside the box. He was also lucky that Welshman immediately saw the possibility of this working and supported him in his efforts. So it's a good sign of the collaboration at work in the huts.
I can't take my eyes off this document that we have in front of us. It is part of our collection and it's a sort of cream-coloured memo, I'd say. It looks like a lot of the other memos that we've seen. It's slightly thin paper, but it's in remarkably good condition. It's been folded into four quarters over time and it's got some typescript on it. What is this document that we're looking at, Dean?
It's a typewritten thank you letter from Herivel sent to all Newmanry staff at the end of the war for the work they've been doing at Bletchley Park. So Herivel was by this time the head of the Newmanry, where German teleprinter ciphers were decrypted using machinery, including Colossus. It's the only version of the document that we have, as far as I'm aware. It was donated to us by Joan Horridge, formerly Joan Stott, who was a Colossus operator, and it was donated in 1998, so quite some time ago now. It's surprising that it's still the only version that we have, so it is seemingly quite rare. It's quite short. As you say, it's quite plain. We have some similar thank you messages written by other people here with signatures and stamps all over them, but this one isn't like that. I'd almost go as far as to say it's fairly nondescript. There's nothing on it at all apart from the message itself. It's not signed, but it is initialed JWJH, and Herivel's full name was John William Jameson Herivel.
Let's hear Dr. Ben Thompson, our usual voice artist, reading the words of that letter.
July the 10th, 1945. Nothing is left for me to say except good luck and goodbye. And this. The Official Secrets Act will be rigidly enforced as long as there is any possibility of another war. But some of you, who live to be very old, may read one day what the work in BP as a whole, of which yours was a vital part, really meant. Not only to your own country, but to the world. And then you can be proud, and tell your grandchildren the story of the tapes that spun on silver wheels, and how the skill and determination of free men and women, guided by the light of reason freely used, helped to turn the evil tide of fascist irrationalism and slavery in Europe. J.W.J. Herivel.
So as you can hear, it's really nicely worded. And what I also like about it is the hint that people may find out about the work that was done here in the future. Other letters similar to this tend to reinforce the need for secrecy, even though the war is over. But Herivel suggests that grandchildren in the future may find out what the work at Bletchley Park meant. And it's quite prescient in that way.
This is your victory. Victory of the cause of freedom is everywhere. In all our long history, we have never seen a greater day than this. Everyone, man or woman, has done their bit. Everyone has tried, none has flinched. Neither the long years, nor the dangers, nor the fierce attacks of the enemy have in any way weakened the unbending resolve of the British nation. God bless you all.
A highlight of 2025 for me personally was to meet veteran and former bomb operator Ruth Bourne, who spoke so eloquently and had us just roaring with laughter at an event celebrating International Women's Day here at Bletchley Park earlier this year. It was after that event that podcast producer Mark Cotton met up with her to ask her about her experiences and memories of VE Day for this particular episode of the Bletchley Park podcast.
I want to take you back 80 years to a 19-year-old or an 18-year-old Ruth. Can you remember how it felt? Because obviously you had an idea that the war was going to end in Europe, didn't you? In those last few days, you must have been getting quite excited, I suppose.
No, you know, it was a very enclosed life, surprisingly. You got up, you went into B block. You did your job, you came out, say it was daytime, you had your tea, and you went together to the pictures or whatever, and you went into what they called the forecastle, and you maybe had board games or you did handwork. Funnily enough, they tried to keep you busy. They were very helpful like that. They had a speaker sometimes to talk about their interests. You went together on your special night out, SOP. You went home. You really were doing a job, and the end of the job was the end of the war. That's what you were working for, just working to finish the war and go back to having a family or going home to stay with your parents or whatever. And you didn't have a lot of information about what was going on. None of us had newspapers. We didn't have time to read anything, let alone a newspaper. We didn't have radio. There was music that was sometimes piped. There was plenty of piped music in the forecastle. It was such an enclosed life. It really was. The only bit of real life was when you went home for your 4 days off. You were all about, how can I have a good time while I'm off? Can I go to the cinema? Will I go to a dance?
Now, if I take you back to that first week in May 1945, and it's announced that the war in Europe is over, were you on watch when you found out that the war was over, or were you off?
I think we'd got up in the morning, and I think we were talking about going to, would it be Gibraltar?
Right.
We were talking about having white cover over our navy blue hats.
Yeah.
And white blackouts. Instead of the black issue pants, we'd have white issue pants. And we were talking about jabs. That's
yes,
right.
Of course, because you'd be going abroad. You'd need to be having jabs.
And somebody said, the war's over, the war's over. That's what it was. We ran down the corridors, and this must have been at Stanmore. We stopped a car in the middle of the road. There was not much traffic in those days,
no
petrol. And we linked hands and said, the war's over, the war's over. Come and have a cup of tea. And believe it or not, they allowed us, this man, he parked up outside the gates, and we brought him to what they called the regulating office and said, can we go to the forecastle and have a cup of tea? And this poor chap, I don't remember his responses or anything. I remember that bit about having a cup of tea. Yeah.
And he probably didn't know that he'd just been let into one of the most top secret places in Britain, did
he? That's right. Well, he didn't let in, though. He only got to the living quarters. We were allowed visitors.
Ah, right.
It was called the regulating office. And I think the regulating office, they were also a bit euphoric. Otherwise, they might not have let us.
Now, later on that day or the next day, you go into London, don't you?
Yeah. Mm.
Can you tell us what happened that evening or that day?
Yes, I do remember various bits. I remember the tube and everybody talking, you know, as I always think of it as an electric buzz. And we got into London. I know we parked ourselves in an overnight billet, one of the YWs or one of those organizations. We bagged a bed, we paid for it. And then the other girl, her name was Rosemary, we went somehow into the forecourt and we shouted, we want the king, we want the king. And they came out and that was jolly. I also have a memory of Lower Regent Street. There are two parallel streets. One is the Lower Regent Street and there's another one. And one of those, there was a building which had something to do with services. And we climbed up onto the first floor. And I remember climbing out onto the balcony, which I shouldn't have done, and waving to the people down below. Funny enough, we had a balcony in Birmingham that I used to climb up and sit on. My parents said, you shouldn't do it, shouldn't do it. So there was I, standing on this balcony, waving to these people. I mean, you just did crazy things. I remember outside the palace, wherever there was a lamppost, there was people climbing up, people taking off their scarves and jackets and whatever, waving. And I remember that evening in Hyde Park Corner and the bonfire and the Americans and other service personnel and maybe other civilians. And maybe they'd taken the waste paper baskets, wooden, or maybe the wooden chairs or benches, whatever. They'd made a bonfire. And we sat around in the dark and we sang, you know, Rule Britannia and things like, and all the modern songs and a few rude sea shanties. And one of the Americans recited a poem. It was risque. I can't remember a word of it, but I know we were all giggling like mad because it was rather rude. That was him. Yeah. And then the next day we gradually, I suppose, we went back. It was only a sleeping out pass.
Now, when you returned to your bomb station, one of the jobs you had shortly afterwards was dismantling the bombs, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
Can you explain what you did there?
It wasn't very exciting. We had these tables and we had V-shaped things, metal. And then we had piles of red wire with metal things. So you had this V and you put the metal thing through it somehow, and you put the soldering iron and you unsoldered it. Then you put the metal things there and the bits of wire there.
And you had miles and miles of this to do.
There were 5 miles of wire in every bomb. So imagine we had 210 bombs. It's plenty of wire to unsolder.
When you look back at what you did during World War II, are you proud of what you did?
I am now, yes. Of course, it's very nice to be made a fuss of. That's also very pleasant. Yeah, I mean, I still am amazed, to be honest, because I'm not really a mathematician. And you have all these millions and millions and millions of possibilities, 158 approximately, million, million, million. How the heck do you even think about? That's why we won, because the Germans were so convinced you couldn't possibly break it under any circumstance. And even when they thought it might be being broken, they didn't do too much. Well, they modified Naval Enigma, put in a couple of wheels. I read somewhere they were frightened to tell Hitler that they were worried that it might be broken. But I'm amazed that Turing and his gang had worked around it. I mean, say, well, we'll make a machine. It'll look for all the wrong answers. It'll only stop if there's a right answer. I mean, how do you think about that?
Well, it's thanks to people like Turing, but also people like you, that we now have the freedoms that we do have. So can I just say, on this VE Day celebration, thank you for your service.
Well, thank you for listening.
If you're interested in hearing more veterans talking about their experiences of VE Day, we think Bletchley Park podcast episode 108, which is Victory in Europe, is a good one to go for, with 20 veterans talking about their experiences.
And now listen, the band is playing Land of Hope and Glory, and the crowd is singing. And this suddenly has become a very moving moment, for Mr. Churchill, too, is singing, and he is conducting the singing of this song. Will you listen, please?
Finally, it's with great sadness that Bletchley Park recently learned of the passing of veteran Betty Webb. Not only was she a great ambassador to the World War II work of those at Bletchley Park, she was also a friend to the Bletchley Park podcast and an inspiration to anyone who heard her talk about her experiences over many years. We wanted to pay tribute to Betty and to let her have the last words of this episode. Mark, you've looked through your recordings of Betty and you've picked out a piece of her talking to you. Why is this piece particularly special?
I think this piece especially because this is going back to 2017, and myself and Catherine were talking to Betty about the importance of the Oral History Project. But it also sums up perfectly what Betty was like. As you say, she was like an ambassador for Bletchley Park. That was her first thought of all times. If she met a stranger, she would give them a leaflet for Bletchley Park.
Mm.
So I think this couple of minutes of Betty out of the hours and hours of recordings that we have of her just perfectly sums her up. And for a last time, we get to say thank you for your service, Betty.
For you personally, why is it so important that these memories are kept alive and these stories are told by the people who were there and people who were involved with them?
Because it's very important that this part of our history is not overlooked or forgotten, because at the time we were literally on a knife edge. I mean, we could well have been invaded and taken over, and our lives would have been totally different from that day on. And I'm very pleased to find that a lot of the schools now are including a certain amount of information about the Second World War in the curriculum.
Do you feel it's been forgotten to a degree in the public consciousness that people don't have that very real, immediate sense of danger and fear that there was at that time?
Yeah, we know the outcome of World War II. We know who won. Mm. The problem is a lot of people probably don't realise how close we came to losing.
For how long?
Yeah.
No, they don't. And even a lot of the people at Bletchley probably didn't realise at the time.
No.
I certainly didn't. It's only through later reading and discussion that one realises what a knife edge we were on.
So, Betty, we're 75 years away from World War II now. Do you hope in another 75 years, another 100 years, that people will be able to listen to your story and your colleagues' stories and still know what you did and understand what you did?
Yes, I hope they will, and I hope they'll realise that it was a unique situation, a unique experience, probably something which will never be seen or heard again. I think it's difficult to imagine that other countries haven't got a similar setup, but to me, it's totally unique. We wouldn't be able to put such a story, if you like, on again.
Mm. And you're going to be going out there carrying on telling your story, aren't you?
I certainly hope to, despite my 93 coming up 94 years. I'm blessed with reasonably good health, and I hope to get out there. And I always carry some literature about Bletchley in my handbag, and I'm still handing it out now.
Well, I went to one of your talks last year, and I think one of the first questions, it wasn't even a question, it was someone congratulating you on how good your legs were, wasn't it?
Yes, that has happened to me. I'm glad they can't see them now.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.